May I have your attention, please? We are at the Palm Coast Community Center for a regularly scheduled meeting of the Palm Coast City Council. Please rise and join with me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please.
Vice Mayor McGuire.
Present.
Councilmember DiLorenzo.
Here.
Councilmember Nobile.
Here.
Councilmember Shipley.
Here.
Mayor Nitz is excused.
Agenda item number one, approval of minutes of the City Council's meeting on June 16th and the workshop on June 30th.
Move approval.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. Agenda item number two, presentation of property tax and millage rate history. Mr. Landon.
This presentation is one of a series. This one is probably one of those that interests a lot of our residents because property taxes are always the most disliked tax, in my opinion, I think most people's opinion. So Chris kind of goes through what this is all about, and no action is necessary. This is just for information as we're right in the middle of our budget season. Lena is off today, so he has to do this solo. So Chris, take it from here.
Thank you. Good evening, Vice Mayor and Council.
Good evening.
With Lena not available, please hold any comments on spelling until the next workshop. Okay, so our budget calendar, our budget preparation timeline started in January. We're now down into June and starting to gear up for property tax discussions. July and August, we'll be working on the details of the budget. September will be our public hearings. And then October through December, we have a number of end of cycle filings and reports that we need to prepare. So we're going to talk about the truth in millage process, which is sometimes referred to the TRIM process. That's the kind of the state outline process we need to file for levying property taxes, and discuss all the different terminology and what it means as it relates to property taxes. So our truth in millage process, again, is just it's what's set out by the state. It drives what we do and when we do it and what the deadlines are. The two deadlines that we've had most recently, June 1st, the property appraiser provides us the total assessed value of property in the city. By July 1st, we kind of get the more official number. The July 1st number is an estimate. The June 1st number is an estimate. The July 1st number is more official. And July 1st officially starts the TRIM calendar or the timeline. So what happens next? So after we receive that July 1st number, City Council during the month of July will have to take action to set the current year proposed or maximum millage rate, and also set the date, time, and meeting place for the first budget hearing in September. This is a quick snapshot of what a TRIM notice looks like. Those are the white notices that we get in the mail in August, that most of which wind up in recycling bins. In September, all taxing authorities are required to hold two public hearings to adopt a millage rate and a budget. Those hearings must be held after 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. And we can't conflict with the county or the school board. In other words, we can't all do it on the same night, and the county and the school board have first choice ahead of us. Some kind of key parts of the process is our proposed or maximum millage rate is kind of our high point. The tentative millage rate, or the millage rate that's adopted at the first budget hearing, cannot be higher than the maximum or proposed millage rate. Not without a lot of significant cost involved for the city. And then the final millage rate, which is the millage rate voted at the second budget hearing, cannot exceed the tentative millage rate that would have been adopted 2 weeks prior. So from basically, the whole process starts with the property appraiser. The property appraiser, the Flagler County property appraiser, assesses the value of all property in Palm Coast, whether it's personal properties of our homes or a commercial property. At the same time, the property appraiser determines the Save Our Homes limitation. This graph kind of shows you the Save Our Homes limitation and what it's done over the last 6 or 7 years. In 2009, it was at a high of just under $700 million. It dropped down as low as $123 million. And for 2015, it climbed back up to $370 million. Why that's important is because that represents a portion of a person's property assessed value that cannot be taxed for property tax purposes.
Chris, I think it's important to mention that when the property appraiser assesses the value of the home, this is not an arbitrary decision on his part. He's given a formula by the state of Florida that he applies to this. So, you know, that's how property values change.
That is correct. Everybody in this process has to follow all the state guidelines and the state formulas that were set up. So this kind of brief example that we've looked at before, if you have some new construction and you have and we use kind of $1 million as a number just to kind of show, make a point here. The first year when you have new construction, basically the market value and the assessed value, you could more or less say is the same. In our example, we're saying, well, hey, each year the market value of our property increases by 50%. And that's the blue columns. But the Save Our Homes limitation limits what could potentially be taxed by the lesser of 3% or the CPI each year. So over time, as the market values grow of the homes, the amount that's potentially available for taxing from a property tax standpoint only grows slightly. So we have a lot of questions about, well, the market values are going up so much, you know, why don't you have more revenue? This is pretty much why you don't have more revenue, because it's limited as to what you can use for levying property taxes. So to get to the actual taxable value of the homes, we take the assessed value, which includes the Save Our Homes exemptions, and then we apply a number of other exemptions. The most popular one that we all know about, of course, is the homestead exemption, but there are a number of others, such as the senior exemption, widow, widower, military exemptions. All of those are kind of handled by the property appraiser's office, so it's important if a resident thinks they might qualify for any of that to contact the property appraiser. Not sure what happened there exactly.
Reboot.
I think the property appraiser turned it off.
I think so. I think that's what happened.
You didn't pay a bill.
It looks like...
It has to be restarted.
Yeah, it's blinking. I'm not sure what that means.
That's not good.
Chris, your department has put together a little glossary and some guidelines on a lot of this terminology and a lot of the phrases and idioms that we use in preparing a budget. Normally we have some of these. Do we have some tonight, perchance?
I'm not sure if there's any back there, Mr. McGuire, but okay. I can check. We usually keep a stock here at the community center okay. for the public.
Yeah, if you don't have one, I suggest you get one, because we've gotten praise from all over the state for putting this together. Other cities go through the same thing. You start talking about the budget, and you look out in the audience, and you see all the glazed eyes there. And so try to bring a little bit more understanding to the process of budgeting.
And that glossary is available at the city website also.
Okay. I don't have any AA batteries, so I hope you can get that thing.
Well, it looks like the projector just went off. There we go. Yeah,
exactly what we thought.
Just make sure the AC's working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're done.
Got that right. This will be the shortest meeting in history.
That looks like we're almost there. Well, while we let it warm up, just want to again reiterate that for residents interested to know if they qualify for any other exemptions. The property appraiser's office is the place to go. They will help with forms and helping them try to identify whether there is something else that they could qualify for.
And that office is on the second floor of the Community Services Center out on 100.
So once we take the assessed value and subtract out the various exemptions, you come down to the actual taxable value. So what we've seen is, okay, we have the market value of the home, then we have an assessed value, which many times is lower due to the Save Our Homes exemptions we talked about earlier, and then it's even further lowered by the various exemptions that we just discussed. That becomes the taxable value of property in Palm Coast and everywhere. So then to determine the actual tax that any individual would pay, you take that taxable value, you multiply it by the millage rate of the taxing authority, and you come up to the actual physical tax that any particular piece of property would pay. In our case, the millage rate, again, it's a rate per $1,000 of assessed taxable value. So for instance, $100,000 of taxable value with a 3.5 millage rate would be $350 annually in taxes. You hear the term rollback rate very often during this process, and the rollback rate is a rate determined, again, by the state formula, is the millage rate that is required to basically collect the same amount of taxes from the previous year, not taking into account things like new construction. So one of the interesting things about Palm Coast, and we kind of look at this comparison each year, is we went ahead, and this is all available through the state and the various state websites, and we looked at cities with a population between 700,000 and 100,000. There's about 10 of them. Out of those 10, Palm Coast has the second lowest millage rate in the state. One of the other things, all the way on the right column to kind of point out, is when we have some discussions about revenue diversification is the public service or utility tax. Palm Coast is one of the few cities in the state, certainly in our size group, that doesn't levy some type of public service tax. Some of the other things you'll note, interesting with the number one lowest is Boca Raton. The taxable value in Boca Raton is well over $18 billion compared to just under $4 billion for Palm Coast. And even though Boca Raton's millage rate is considerably lower than Palm Coast, they generated over $62 million in taxes versus just over $16 million for Palm Coast. So there's a lot of things that go into that, a lot of different types of property. It's always difficult to compare one city to another, but it's just some interesting facts about our tax situation here in Palm Coast. This is our millage rate history, our property value, again, in the billions. The various millage rates that have been charged over the years, as well as the ad valorem receipts or property tax receipts. 2008 was our peak, just over $7 billion in taxable property value, which generated a little over $20 million in tax receipts. We've gone down, actually, over $4 million a year in tax receipts since that time frame. In 2015, we collected just under $16 million, again, versus just over $20 million in 2008, which says a lot about how Palm Coast has been doing with its budgets. At the very bottom, I just want to point out the area in green. This is the official number from the property appraiser for fiscal year 16 tax purposes, $4.142 billion in taxable value. A little over $63.5 million of that is from new construction. This is a snapshot of a property tax bill. I just want to point out in the center, kind of three center columns, the assessed value, exemption amounts, and taxable value. This one, I believe, is actually my house. You can see that the exemption in my case, I qualify for the homestead exemption. That's the $50,000 or $25,000 you see in that third column from the left. And then the taxable value is in the second column from the right. And those taxable values are multiplied by the various millage rates, which is on the first column from the left, generating the taxes for each of the jurisdictions. The only portion that the Palm Coast City Council has any control over is the City of Palm Coast line, which is generally at the bottom of the tax bill. It represents just over 20% of a citizen's total tax bill. This is an area that there's a lot of misunderstanding on, especially with the phone calls I receive from citizens. They look at their total tax bill, and they assume that the Palm Coast City Council has control over their total tax bill when they really only have control over that one line of the tax bill. This is just a graphical look, again, at the property tax collections from 2011 to 14. The collections were relatively flat, and they were down under $5 million a year from our peak in 2008. And fiscal year 15 was the first year in 5 years where we actually saw an increase in tax collections. This graph represents the adopted millage rate versus the rollback rate. Again, the rollback rate is the rate that you would charge to collect the same taxes from 1 year to the next. The adopted rate is in black, and the green is the rollback rate. And in all years from 2008 to 2014, we were at or below the rollback rate, and that's one of the reasons why we actually collected less taxes than we did in 2008 forward. 2015 was the first year in 7 or 8 years that we actually went the other way, where the adopted millage rate was a little bit above the rollback rate. This graph for the last 4 years represents the percentage of property, residential versus commercial. So in other words, of all the taxable value of property in Palm Coast, between 82 and 84% is residential, whether it's vacant or actual developed properties. By far, that's the larger proportion, and the largest amount of taxes are paid by the residents. Get a lot of questions about what our property taxes actually pay for. Well, over 60% of our property taxes that we receive pay for the fire department and the additional police protection with contract with the sheriff. A little over 35% pay for all of our street and park maintenance, including things like street lights, taking care of all of our parks, sidewalks, things of that nature. A very small portion, about a little over $300,000, goes to capital projects and the stormwater fund. So we do this exercise each year. We add up all of the tax revenue that the city receives, not just our own source revenue, but also revenues we receive as pass-throughs, such as grants, because the state and federal grants that we receive are just our tax dollars we pay to another jurisdiction. When we add those all together, of what the city receives each year, and then divide it by the population, including grants, the city receives $48 a month, or $576 a year per city resident. If we eliminate the grants and just focus on our own source revenues, the city receives about $31 a month, or $374 per year per resident in the city. And again, just a little bit more detail about what those pay for. Our public safety, emergency services, and additional law enforcement. Code enforcement, housing programs, streets, maintenance, resurfacing, all kinds of work inside the neighborhoods, as well as all of our parks, paths, trails, and related construction. So things like the renovation at Holland Park would be included in that. So what's next? So our next budget workshop on the 14th, we'll dive into the general fund in more detail. At the next council meeting on the 21st, council will be in a position and asked to adopt a maximum millage rate. Again, that's the rate that'll go out on the trim notices. And then the 28th of July through the end of August, there will be additional budget workshops and budget discussions culminating in the September public hearings. We don't have those dates yet, but we should have them in the next week or so. But there will be two Wednesdays in September. And that's it.
Council questions, comments?
None.
Thank you, Chris. Agenda item number 3. An ordinance adopting proposed land development code amendment, updating standards for drinking establishments, fences, and walls. Mr. Reichman?
Yes, Mr. Vice Mayor and Council. This is an ordinance for the City of Palm Coast, Florida, amending the city's Unified Land Development Code. In Chapter 3, Zoning, Uses and Dimensional Standards, Section 3.03.02, Non-Residential and Mixed-Use Districts. Allowable uses, including Table 3-4, to update the appropriate zoning classifications for drinking and eating establishments. Amending Chapter 4, Conditions for Limited Specific Uses and Activities, Section 4.0102, Fences and Walls, to modify various standards for fences and walls. Amending Chapter 14, Glossary, Section 14.02, glossary to delete definitions for club and private club, and add definitions for bottle club, civic club, drinking establishment, fence, landscape feature, microbrewery, fast food restaurant, sit-down restaurant, and wall, providing for codification, conflicts, severability, and providing an effective date.
Council questions? Does anyone from the public wish to address this first reading of this proposed ordinance?
Vice Mayor, we actually have a presentation that might be helpful.
I thought that was your presentation.
No, that was just the reading of
the... That's pretty good to me.
That was the dance.
I read it so well.
Yeah. Okay. I beg your pardon. Please make your presentation.
Yep. City Council, a few months ago, brought to staff's attention some issues, both in our fence code and also kind of outdated language and provisions in our zoning code regarding establishments that serve alcoholic beverages. So we've gone through quite a lengthy public process and have a proposal for you tonight we'd like to go over to how to amend our code to address some of these issues. Bill's going to do the presentation for us.
I'll drink to that.
Clear back on January 13th, the City Council requested the planning staff to review our fencing and wall standards and specifically look at whether fences along saltwater canals should be open or reduced in height as they approach the canals in order to maintain views of the waterways for adjacent property owners. Staff brought back presentations to the City Council on both March 10th and March 31st, and then based on City Council's direction, planning staff prepared an ordinance, brought that to the Planning Board at a May 20th workshop. And on June 3rd, the Planning Board recommended that the City Council pass the ordinance by a 6-0-1 vote. In the consensus between the City Council's initial direction and the Planning Board, there's five items that everyone's agreed on: allow more colors for metal and vinyl fences, stop requiring fences to be set back 3 feet from right-of-ways, golf courses, and canals so that there could be 3-foot wide planting areas, and everyone agreed that those planting areas would also be dropped. And then in fences in side yards where the fence faces a street, there would no longer be required to plant shrubs in front of that. And the next item is a newer type fence that everyone agreed to allow. These are the precast concrete fences, and that those would be the ones that they're in a wood, stone, and brick simulated pattern. And the last item was within 20 feet of saltwater canals, require the fences to either be open or reduced in height to 4 feet. And last week we had a discussion on easements and fences and walls where they may have some conflicts. And item B shows that if someone turns in a request for a fence or wall in a drainage easement, the building department would send that to the stormwater section for them to look at before that permit would be issued. And what we're doing in item C is a couple things. We're explaining that yes, you can put the fence up as long as it does not interfere with any utilities. So it gives the engineering and the planning staff and utilities an opportunity to review that in case there is some kind of conflict. And previously it says that the property owner, if they elected to put the fence up in the easement, that it would be at their cost for it to be removed, and it was open, and it was sort of vague on what happens if the fence is taken down by the utility company, who's responsible for putting it back up. So last week we mentioned that the replacement would be on the property owner's expense too, and that's sort of customary out there with other communities.
I got a question. Can you go back? So what we're talking about is a fence within an easement, and give me an example of that.
Here's an example. Sometimes it's right higher plan, man. This is a norm.
Now there you go.
Give you an example. When AT&T developed our lots, they created easements, and a lot of these easements are about 15 feet if they have culvert pipes or drainage facilities going in between the houses. So okay. The easement's there to protect the utility. So when a fence permit comes in, typically the 5-foot easement around the normal houses, that's, you know, typically that's not going to cause an issue. But what we would do is we would review the permit, and if the fence is being proposed on top of that 15-foot easement, then we would send that, you know, to our stormwater professionals who will look at it and analyze it. And sometimes it's very common, you know, to tell the property owner, hey, can you scoot it over 5 feet so you're not on top of the pipe? That's our regular standard, and that's what we practice. This just gives us some added protection in case, you know, a fence was put in, maybe there wasn't a permit, that they would be responsible if we had to someday replace the pipe.
Okay.
But I would think that would only be if they didn't have a permit, because if they had a permit, we'd allow them to do that, right?
Yeah. If they have a permit and we looked at it and we're analyzing it, and we will have them move it to make sure that it does not conflict with our stormwater facilities, as an example.
And planning staff mentioned last week that we had a definition that we were proposing, and we've added the sentence in red there based on direction we received last week. And so what we have now is a landscape feature is an embellishment to the natural environment by blending man-made or natural materials with plantings in order to improve the outdoor aesthetics of a property. Landscape features, which include decorative planters, stonework, or brickwork, shall not exceed 3 feet in height. A landscape feature, as defined herein, is not a fence or wall. And where we're really leading to is, for instance, you're not allowed to put the fence up in the front yard, but there's a lot of these things here which are landscape features. And here's another example. So you can see where the 3 feet would allow both of these type of landscape features in a front yard between the house and the street.
But they can only be of those three materials?
No, what we're saying with those materials, that you can't exceed the 3 feet in height. So if you get into a situation where you have a wall, a foundation, that's going to be regulated by the building permit. What we're trying to do here is just to really clarify, to make a little bit more clear than our past code, that with landscape features, we're not regulating landscape features. You know, people want to do brick around their plants at their house, so be it. Yep.
So I'm okay. It just because it says decorative planters, stone, brick, does that limit the...
No, it doesn't. What that's trying to do is it further is providing some clarification about what landscape features can be. Gives some examples. Yeah. For example, it says landscape features, this is in the new red sentence, which include... Doesn't mean that's it. Just means that these are some examples, which include decorative planters, stonework, and brickwork. But basically, the key part of this, landscape features shall not exceed 3 feet in height.
Yeah, good.
That's the key.
Okay, I just want to make sure we're not limiting to those.
No. I was giving some
materials.
I want to clarify, you know, if someone comes in with a 3-foot high fence along the whole front of their property and say, well, that's a landscape feature, we aren't going to approve that. That's a fence.
Right.
By definition.
Right.
You know, so it's, you know, this isn't trying to say that you could have a 3-foot fence. This is trying to say that as long as it's part of your landscaping, and obviously part of your landscaping, but as soon as you get over 3 feet high,
then you start getting into structural issues and building code issues, et cetera, that you've got a whole different ballgame to deal with.
Okay. I've seen a house. I'm not going to tell you where because I don't know if it's good or not. Where they had, for instance, bushes and then what I guess what you would assume to be a fence. I don't know what else to call it. It wasn't higher than 3 feet. Then, you know, it was like 6 foot of bushes, 4 feet of that fence, and then bushes, that would be...
That's the kind of thing that I think most architects would say. It's a blending of the...
Architect and the landscaping.
The landscaping and the features, okay. Et cetera.
So you've got to be creative.
Yep. Gotcha. I'm not trying to deny the creativity, but just a solid or continuous fence
is
around
a fence.
Your property is a fence. Yeah. I mean, I don't care how high it is.
Gotcha.
Now, switching over to the second part of the presentation on drinking establishments, planning staff made one presentation to the city council at their March 10th workshop. We then prepared an ordinance based on council's direction, presented it to the planning board on May 20th, and then on June 3rd, the planning board recommended by a 6-0-1 vote to the city council that they recommend to approve it. And there's four things that's there, the consensus between the city council and the planning board. One is we've modified our land use standards so bars, taverns, and nightclubs are not allowed in the office or the neighborhood commercial districts. We modified our thresholds for distinguishing from higher and lower intensity bars. And previously, this was done with two items. One was whether it had a discotheque and live entertainment, and everyone agreed that a better threshold would be to use outdoor entertainment. We also updated the terminology on drinking and eating establishments to improve their clarity in the breakdown of allowable uses in Table 3-4, and both of those are in the same subsection of that table. And the new definitions include bottle club, civic club, drinking establishment, microbrewery, fast food restaurant, and sit-down restaurant. And planning staff recommends that the city council approve this ordinance amending our land development code standards on fences, walls, and drinking establishments as presented. And we're open for further discussion.
Council questions?
Nope.
Anyone from the public wish to be heard on this item, please approach the podium, give us your name, rank, and serial number, and limit your comment to 3 minutes.
Jack Carroll, 84427, from Palm Coast. I didn't see anything here to show anything concerning these fences that are falling apart. Now, if you drive along Belt here or some of the other streets, you'll see a nice looking fence, then you'll see a fence that's coming apart. So what are we doing to correct those kind of a condition? Belt Terrace, you know, is a well-ran highway. So thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else from the public wish to be heard on this? Okay, come back to council. You want to address fences on Belt Terrace?
Yes, that's in the code of ordinances, and tonight we're amending the land development code. So it's really a code enforcement type issue.
Okay.
There, Mr. Vice Chairman and Council, and for the public, our code of ordinances, which Bill just referenced, have maintenance standards. And in those maintenance standards, those apply to structures in general and fences specifically. So if the code enforcement department becomes aware of a violation of our code of ordinances, specifically with the condition of a fence, they're going to initiate the code enforcement process. So it's just a matter of making code enforcement aware of a condition issue out there.
Thank you, Mr. Reichman. You asked your question, Jack? Okay. Come back to council. There's no further questions. The council will entertain a motion.
move approval of agenda item number 3, an ordinance adopting proposed land development code amendment, updating standards for drinking establishments, fences, and walls.
Second.
Motion has been moved and seconded. This will require a roll call vote, please.
Councilmember DiLorenzo?
Yes.
Councilmember Nobile?
Yes.
Councilmember Shipley?
Yes.
Vice Mayor McGuire?
Yes.
Vice Mayor, this motion passes 4-0.
Thank you. Item number 4, a resolution approving a final plat for Airport Commerce Center, Phase 2A replat.
Mr. Vice Mayor, this is a quasi-judicial matter. If there have been any ex-party communications, those should be disclosed at this time.
Mr. Nobile?
No.
Mr. DiLorenzo?
None.
Ms. Shipley?
No.
I have none.
This is, Council, this is a fairly basic ministerial type plat, replat. You know, you have actually seen the zoning, the annexation. This is where there's a proposed convenience store to be located. It's one of those final steps before they can start construction. Constance will give you a short presentation on the details.
Good evening, Vice Mayor and City Council.
Good evening.
The location of the plat is on the southwest corner of State Road 100 and Seminole Woods Boulevard. It is a replat of the Airport Commerce Center plat, a Tract D, and a portion and Lot 4. It is a mixed use. Future land use designation, and it's a commercial subdivision of 4 lots. And it will also include a conservation tract to preserve the wetlands. We also received a performance surety for the cost to construct public infrastructure improvements, and staff is requesting approval for the final plat of Airport Commerce Center Phase 2 and authorizing mayor to execute the plat and staff to issue a final plat development order for application 2897.
Council questions, comments? Anyone from the public wish to be heard on item number 4, Airport Commerce Center? Seeing no one approach the podium, we'll come back to council for questions, comments, or a motion.
Move approval of agenda item number 4, a resolution approving final plat, Airport Commerce Center Phase 2, a replat.
Second.
Motion has been received and seconded. Again, we will require a roll call vote.
Councilmember DiLorenzo?
Yes.
Councilmember Nobile?
Yes.
Councilmember Shipley?
Yes.
Vice Mayor McGuire?
Yes.
Vice Mayor McGuire, this motion passes 4-0.
Thank you.
I have a second one. Pardon? Question.
Oh, sure.
You're not allowed to do that.
It's a procedural question. It's not
procedural, that's all.
Agenda item number 5. A resolution approving a contract with Buxton Company for strategic planning and business recruitment. Mr. Landon?
City Council, this is part of our Prosperity 2021 initiative to try to help bring and retain businesses here in Palm Coast. We have always focused on small businesses for the last few years. And this was trying to take it to a new level with something that would be new for us and new for our private sector partners. And Bo and our guest is going to present this, what I consider a very exciting program that should be a real benefit for particularly our retail mix here in Palm Coast. Bo, if you'll take it from here.
Good evening, Vice Mayor and Council. Wow, this thing's loud. Last week at workshop, tried to cover a comprehensive view of our activities, programs, and efforts, not only of the city, but our partners in the realm of economic development through Prosperity 2021. And over the last 5 years, have made some substantial progress to that end. Even though things have improved in our local economy, we're still always looking for ways to keep our local dollars here by having our residents shop here in Palm Coast Flagler, and also attracting investment, commercial investment, and especially looking at the property value slide that Chris had up about the amount of residential property tax base. With that, the economic development team started searching for ways to expand those programs and projects. We took a look at retail recruitment as a strategy after visiting Florida International Council of Shopping Centers, and found there was a real need in our community to connect retailers with our developers and brokers to make deals happen, to make investments happen, and hopefully to keep our residents here locally and not going north or south on 95 for retail. So with that, we put out an RFP for request for proposals from consultants. We had 4 responses. The top-ranked consultant was Buxton. Representative here tonight is Ryan Stewart. He will present kind of their firm's approach to retail recruitment. And at the end, I can cover the 2 contractual options that we have engaging Buxton should you take action tonight. With that, I'll turn it over to Ryan.
Hello? Oh, perfect. Thank you, Council, for allowing us the opportunity to share with you what Buxton is about tonight. For some of you, you've already seen this, but we wanted to share this with everyone here. A Buxton partnership allows the community to be proactive, not only in retail recruitment, but also retention and education for your local business owners that you have in place now. A partnership allows Palm Coast to increase tax revenues both with sales tax and property tax, provide amenities that your constituents, your workforce, your visitors want, and also, again, help you retain your local business owners. Tonight we wanted to touch on 4 key elements about Buxton, but also share some preliminary findings that we found first and foremost. When you look at Palm Coast, there's roughly 77,000 to 78,000 individuals within the city limits. When we used the anchor site of Highway 100 and Interstate 95, we pulled a 15-minute drive time, which shows there's roughly almost 90,000 individuals that are in your market. So we then took it a step further and looked at the highest percentage of population that are most similar and how they live their lives and spend their money. Just to give you some insights, those blue dots represent their density and where they're located within the city. And to further add some insights, 56% of those own HDTVs, which means they're consuming media off of internet, cable, satellite. 18% have been on a cruise, and almost a third of them are consuming USA Today on a regular basis. What's really important to understand is that when we look at the retail landscape of Palm Coast, there's close to $300 million that are not being accounted for, which means there's a demand of at least that much here in the community. So there's definitely a need, that's probably something you guys already knew, that you guys were underserved when it came to retail. We took that a step further and broke that down into subcategories. So moving to the left of that 1.0 line shows what we call leakage or demand not being met. And you can see in almost every category, there's opportunity to improve the retail landscape. Anything to the right of that 1.0 line is surplus. And surplus is not a bad thing. If you think about a restaurant row or shopping centers that are located together or entertainment districts that are closely located together, you can have surplus, which just means you're bringing dollars in from outside of your area. I think it's important to note that Buxton is a consumer analytic firm. We're the largest one in the U.S., and having the ability and the power of data that we have, we can help leverage that insights into all aspects of the community. And we've done that for many communities in the past. So, for instance, we can help you understand what types of park projects would be best utilized in the community. What is the new mover profile going to look like, and how does that change the landscape of Palm Coast? visitor and tourism, healthcare. We have hundreds of healthcare clients, and we can leverage those insights with our public sector as well. So our main goal today here, obviously, is retail. When you look at Buxton, you have to start with retail and our background there. We have been in the retail sector for over 21 years, leveraging our insights and our models to help make multi-million dollar decisions for our retailers. So we've worked with over 3,000 brands across the U.S. For instance, when Trader Joe's wanted to move from California to the East Coast, they really had no clear understanding of who their best customers were going to be and where they should be locating those stores. So we're helping put those locations in Florida, in Georgia, and Texas, all across the U.S. We help do that for millions of consumers and help understand what types of products should be in their stores as well. Oops. Just to give you an idea of our retail footprint within the U.S., in the past 12 months, 80,000 sites were evaluated by Buxton. Those are those green dots you see on the map. 7,500 of those, the gold dots, became actual brick-and-mortar locations that we opened. To give you further insight into Buxton, that represents about 25% of all retail stores that were opened in the U.S. in the past 12 months. Our approach with the public sector, with our communities, is two-pronged. One, recruit retail, obviously, bring in those retailers that are not here now that are needed. And also, we have a suite of tools that are dedicated to local business owners and helping them educate them and retain them. So when Buxton started on the retail side, the mantra in real estate location and site selection was location, location, location. Buxton turned that on its head and changed that mantra from location, location, location to helping retailers understand their most important variables are who are my customers, where are they located, and what's their value to me. We take that same approach with our communities, helping them understand who are their citizens as consumers, what do they like, dislike, what are their shopping preferences, where are they located within the community, and then what's their value back to those retailers. For the past 12 years, we've worked with over 700 communities across the U.S., all sizes, shapes, diversities, all the different goals in mind. We have communities of 5,000 in rural Maine, all the way up to major metros, Atlanta, Dallas, Washington, D.C., Orlando, have all been clients of Buxton or currently with Buxton. We've been recognized for our efforts. I think the one that hits closest to home for the public sector is ICMA. We're their strategic partner in educating city managers across the U.S. and understanding what are the trends in retail, how can we better educate them, and how can they go out and be equipped to deal with that with their own communities. So data and methodology, how do we really get to our answers? I mentioned earlier that we're the largest consumer network firm in the U.S. We have over 250 data sets that we source. We have exclusive relationships with the largest credit card processor in the U.S. We're the only ones that are allowed access to transactional level data. We use that data to help understand these three key factors about a community: the consumer profile, the drive time trade area, and the retail market conditions around that area. So when communities first start out with recruitment, oftentimes they're only armed with demographic information. This is insightful, but for a retailer, it's not actionable. It does not tell a retailer if you're going to shop in my store or dine in my restaurant. What Buxton does is go from basically this 30,000-foot view of the community, not only down to the doorstep level, but to the individual level. So now we understand that Ben drives a truck, he has one child, and he's a Netflix subscriber, while Tom drives a Volvo sedan, has three children, and goes to the movies on average 0.9 times a month. Why is that important? If I'm AMC or I'm Regal Cinemas and I want to move to Palm Coast, I need to know there are more Tom Kings out there in your market. All that information is then gathered and we look at drive time. So this is a metric that retailers use that we help understand what is the convenience of that location to all of those consumers. Oftentimes, we know how many minutes it takes us to get to our favorite store, but not how many miles it is. And that's the same way retailers look at a community. So it's also important to note that those drive times change based upon the concept, based upon time of day or day of week. So, for instance, if I'm a quick serve restaurant, my drive time during the lunch rush might be 5 or 6 minutes. In the evening, it might grow to 9 or 10 minutes, and then on the weekends, it might grow to 15. There's literally thousands of drive times that we calculate and use with all of those different concepts to help understand what's the real picture here within the community. That last step is looking at retail market conditions. So where is that competition specific to that retailer? Where are there other stores located? What's the impact going to be with a new location open with, in correlation with their other stores? What's the road network look like? What does the site look like? Is the site undeveloped? Is it developed? Does it have sewer? All of those are part of the process when we go into retail market conditions. What other types of draws are in here that are not retail, associated with retail? So healthcare, hospitals, being the county seat, tourism draws, the beaches, all of that is taken into account when we go through that process. So we take all that information and we basically combine it so that we understand who you are as a community and who do you best match with on the retail side. We are the only firm in the U.S. that can match you to specific retailers because of that unique experience and expertise we have on the retail side. We're the only firm out there that does that because we have that ability. We know what these retailers are looking for. We've worked with almost two-thirds of them that have their doors open today. So we are matching you to those specific retail concepts. The Scout platform that we use is proprietary to us, and it has grown from just being a portal to Buxton, but now also a recruitment tool. So now we have the ability to put all of your information onto a tablet or mobile device so that anywhere you are, whether it's at a retail deal-making conference or you have a site selector on the ground or you're with a developer, you can share all that information. Scout Touch allows us to access that information with the touch of a button. So it is app-based, and it allows us to literally extract information that would take several minutes in creating that report, now to an instant. So Scout Touch allows us to capture all of those retailers that we're focused on. And then as we go through the engagement process and we start to begin to recruit these retailers, all of their information is there located within Scout Touch, so that if you're meeting with Target, for example, these six icons represent basically chapters in a book. We can visually share with them and show them on a map where that location is going to be. Again, where is their competition? Where are their other stores located? What insights from the community need to be added to that conversation? And then we can validate that. So we build recruitment packets for each and every one of those specific retailers, and all of the information that they want to see is there. Validated through the data. So not only are we showing them, consumer site and those that are in that site, but then we can score that site with all the metrics that they're looking at. And then we can take it a step further and show them how that compares to the actual locations they have open today. Again, we're the only firm that has that ability because we have that expertise. This is huge for retailers because we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. On the retail side, they're getting information that's very similar to this when they're making site selection decisions with us. So it's an instant apples-to-apples comparison. We also have what we call city-seeking retail. So I know we touched on this last time, but we are unbiased and want to be a partner to our communities, give you that true reality of who you are today, and then build a strategic plan to help you move forward. We also are the same way with our retailers. We don't want to push our retailers in any direction, but we want to be able to bridge the gap and communicate and share that information as best we can. So one of the ways that we did that in 2014 was City Seeking Retail. So now our retailers can go on to their Scout platform, and let's say that they're finally ready to make a move to Florida. They can instantaneously zoom in on Florida, see our public sector clients, show the contact information here. We can have all of your inventory of real estate available, and they can run their own analysis through Scout with a touch of a button. This is huge for us because we have over 2,500 daily retail users on Scout each and every day. I mentioned retention. This is can be pulled on Scout Touch and also through your desktop portal, but all of the marketing insights that your local business owners would want to see can be pulled from here as well. So we can show them where their specific drive time would be. What does that look like? How should they be marketing to their consumers? We can go into even further detail and show them what types of products should be on their shelves based upon residential and workforce population. So I shared with you the example of a local restaurant. We can show them what types of beer that they have the highest preference to be purchased by their residents and by that workforce population. Why that's important is now they have the ability to better estimate what inventory they should be picking up, what type of brands they should be carrying, what type of special should they be running on a weekly basis versus a weekend. All of that is through Scout Touch, and your local businesses would have that access as well. The other last piece that we wanted to touch on was implementation and account management. So we take a very focused approach to making sure that our clients are serviced appropriately. We basically become an extension of Palm Coast and your ED department. So anytime that they need support, whether that's in person or oftentimes we're part of conversations with retailers at the city level, or if they're at a deal-making conference, we offer our resources there at those conferences so that we can be a part of those conversations, just so that we can be a partner to you guys in any way that we can. We also do ongoing trainings so that personnel can have access to Scout, and also however the city wants to roll out this to local business owners, we can help with that as well. So roughly 65 days from execution, we should have those first subset of the highest qualified retailers for Palm Coast, and then begin the recruitment process. We reach out to those retailers proactively with you all, and then we walk through those steps together. Again, we basically become an extension of your team. Oftentimes, as Palm Coast gets through the process and it's down to one or two other communities for that retailer, they're going to start asking for more focused information, and we're able to provide that at no additional cost. We've looked back and taken a high focus on satisfaction with our clients. We score ourselves the same way that Fortune 500 companies do on the NPS score. So it's basically a benchmark for all corporations that are serious about customer service. We score in the same category with the brands you see up there today. And we included some comments from those clients that have used us before, and our current clients actually. So just to recap, Buxton is a partner to you all. We take and preach a proactive approach. We applaud Palm Coast for taking the same approach. We are the experts in retail, and we've helped recruit over 35 million square feet of retail space. We bring a unique insight to the community that no other firm has the ability to do today. We've helped communities with all sorts of projects, and we would be honored to work with you all. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer those.
Council questions?
I do have one question. If somebody wanted to open a retail shop in Palm Coast, would they go through the BAC, or is there something that would be right on Palm Coast Gov that sends them right to your website?
Yep, that's a great question. So every community kind of handles that differently based upon the resources that they have. They would not have access directly to Scout. We would have to have an intermediary between the two. So the reason we do that is to limit the bandwidth of Scout. We really want high-level users on there. But sometimes chambers will take that over. Small business associations will take that over. And that's where we come out and would be more than happy to help, you know, find that point person, train them. They're more than able to call us and help pull that information. This information is yours. I think it's also important to note that it's not static information, so it's a dynamic model. As our databases are refreshed and renewed with new information, that's automatically rolled out to our clients. So ongoing, we work with that. It depends on each community.
If I could add to that, you know, if it's a new business that's just coming into town, our BAC is the best way to go. Buxton is a resource. They are not going to be the point for Palm Coast, but they become a resource. And it depends on the different type of business. Many of them, you know, the large retailers, national retailers, they're already going to have background about Palm Coast. They already done some research, et cetera. And then we can help them hopefully put the final decision together. And we do that all the time. And that's with our BAC, and we'll use Buxton as a resource to help with that.
Council questions?
I have a statement more than a question. I think, personally, I think it's a very good idea. I think this is a very good resource. I think information is king. It's always been king. But one thing I want to be, I would like us as a council to be careful of is not to overrun the mom and pop shops by just going out and drenching in the you know, the big box retailers. Would like to help the entrepreneurs, you know, get, you know, be able to grow businesses here. Generally, businesses that are privately owned, locally owned, and them and their employees tend to make a higher salary. So just want us to be mindful of that when we move forward, is that we're focusing, you know, not on this, but on our community, and like Mr. Landon said, is using this as a resource to grow it.
Yep, and I can speak to that as well. We have, we do show all our national brands that we work with, but we have a Florida brand, the Cheese Course. It's a high-end cheese boutique. Any retailer that has more than three locations, we can match them to Palm Coast.
Good.
So, you know, if there's a specific need or a specific want out there, all that's uncovered in the beginning of the partnership so that we have a better understanding of what the focus is, what the goals are. So we can definitely arrange that.
And I would like to address that this, and that's one of the reasons why Ray, our director of our BAC, is in the audience. This isn't changing our focus of assisting small businesses. That's one of our key cores to our economic vitality in the community. This is intended to augment that. This is the next step. It is no way intended to replace it. The small businesses are still extremely important. But what you find that if we can keep people in town, you know, and they don't have to go out of town, because when they go out of town, then they spend all their money out of town. And right now there are certain items, as we all know, that we have to, when we go shopping, we go out of town, and that hurts our local small businesses too. So this is trying to keep people from having to get on the highway to go out and spend their disposable income here, which helps everybody, including create more jobs and then keep all those local dollars here locally as possible.
The reality is that there are a lot of empty storefronts in the city of Palm Coast, and if this program fills some of them up, then it's money well spent.
Yes.
Jason, you had a comment?
Two questions. One, once the analysis is done and you start working with actual recruiting and doing the matching, I believe you touched on it, but I'm going to make sure I heard you correctly during our workshop, that you're going to be able to provide us feedback from the site selectors, real estate professionals, on any barriers or hindrances to the development process, codes and development review process, that type of stuff. Is that correct?
So we will go into, during that implementation phase and the uncovering process, we will look at, you know, again, what are the needs and wants? Are we looking for a specific retail concept? Does it match with what we've already kind of preliminary done before we even do the full-blown process? If there are specific retailers that come back as not a match that you are interested in, we'll certainly share that information of why. It's not based, so some of it is, it depends on the retailer. Sometimes it is maybe about code, or it might be litigious issues, but most of it is really based upon, again, who's living here, who's working here, what are their needs and wants, and do they match to, is there the right amount of those individuals within that market trade area, basically?
I'll tell you why I asked the question, is that we hear fairly regularly that, oh no, they won't come here. They told me they won't come here because we're too difficult to deal with, or our codes are too onerous.
or we like a certain type of development, and that's too expensive. If you run into that, will we receive that type of feedback when you do start speaking with retailers, when you start making those matches? If that's coming, if that's what you're hearing back, are we going to hear that back?
So those barriers are common. I will tell you that they are used as good excuses oftentimes.
Mm-hmm.
So our job really is to break that down again. So another way to look at that is retailers will say, oh, well, you're on our five-year plan. But we can do the analysis and show them how much potential is here now and bump that up to maybe 18 months or 2 years. So there's value in being able to, again, validate yourself. So even if there are those barriers, if we can show them what the opportunity is truly, oftentimes that we can overcome those barriers. So we see that a lot. It really comes down to really doing the analysis and understanding what is the real opportunity here.
Right.
But it's commonplace.
Okay. My other question is for Bo. Bo, the dollars here in this budget item, are any of these dollars still remaining from the breakup of Enterprise Flagler? Are those these dollars that were returned back to us from that, or are these new budgeted dollars? They were budgeted, but I mean, are they new dollars for this year?
The dollars for this contract, whatever option should go forward, would come out of the economic development budget, out of the general fund. There is a special projects fund of $75,000 in that fund. The former Enterprise Flagler dollars were put into a separate account by Chris because it has restrictions on it. When they dissolved, from the minutes of their meeting, it was for to be used for purposes of the Palm Coast Business Assistance Center. At the time, the intention was to do the small business revolving loan program. Currently, we don't have any banks participating in that program anymore, so that'll be something determined in the future about how those dollars are used, but they are earmarked for purposes of the Business Assistance Center. So we're still
about how I know probably Chris are better for this, but do you have an idea of how much that
I
is?
I think it's $55,000.
Is that correct? So a little over $56,000.
Yeah, $56,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I think we've expressed the opportunity that the BAC will have to use this tool as well. So I just mentioned that as we look at this budget in the future.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other council questions, comments? Anyone from the public wish to be heard on this item, please approach the podium. Hurry up, I'm going to have to beat you back with a 2x4.
I got a couple of questions I'd like to know. Jack Carroll, when Buxton goes out to these different organizations, do they come here first to see what we have, what we don't have, what's available, what's not available, and what kind of a tax they're going to bring to these people? And what is are they going to actually know what they're going to come into? So when you go to a big company and says, well, we got a good place here in Palm Coast, and the company says, what do you got? Now, are they going to be here to make sure that they know what what the locations are? And I know they know what the people are, but that's what I want to know. Will the companies be well aware of what's happening here before they even come? And the second question I want is, how does that affect our taxes?
Thank you, Jack. Any other public comments, questions? Okay. Would you like to address that?
Can I start off?
Sure.
I'll start off pre-Buxton. In approaching retailers, we're basically only armed with our demographics that we have, and they're very basic. And typically, we hit barriers. For example, with restaurants, I think everyone would agree we're fairly underserved, especially in the State Road 100 area. And typically what we hear is that because the barrier that I hear is that our daytime population isn't high enough. With Buxton, I think Ryan can cover it, but we're armed with a little more information than just our basic demographics. So, all right.
Yep. So, again, when we do that analysis, we first understand what's the goal? Are we looking at a whole corridor? Are we looking at a specific site? Do we want to do a community-wide analysis? So we're taking all that into consideration. So before we even do any matching, we are looking, doing a full analysis of what's going on in Palm Coast, not only on a psychographic level, on the resident level, but also what's the real environment look like? The road network, the traffic counts, all that's taken into account. So yes, that is.
Jack, you satisfied? Okay. All right, come back to council.
Vice Mayor, if I could add to the second part of the equation.
Please do.
As far as taxes, obviously in Chris's previous presentation was about 85% of, I think it was 85%, was residential in nature. The idea would be to hopefully shift that, more commercial, obviously, makes a huge dent in that equation. Also, of course, we have local option sales tax. We have state revenue sharing with our sales taxes. Now, we've seen increases in the past year, and our goal would be to continue that increase and add to it. So hopefully that burden of the residential tax base would decrease over time.
Bo, do you know about how many empty storefronts we have in the city of Palm Coast?
More than 10.
We have quite a bit of space chopped up into very small square footages, and that's pretty typical of a beachfront or a coastal community that is residential in nature. It's kind of what developers do. They make it small and sell it hopefully for big, and then when the market crashes, you have a lot left over. So, but ideally, yes, our goal is to fill up some of that store frontage that's empty.
Yeah, sure is. Thank you. All right. Mr. Reichman, point of procedure, does this require a roll call vote?
Does not.
Okay.
Vice Mayor, I'm sorry for the interruption. I forgot to cover the two options that you have for contracting with Buxton this evening. The first, our standard service contract is a 3-year with two renewal extensions, and it has a cancellation for convenience, which means after a year we can cancel the contract. That contract rate negotiated, of course, is $50,000 with Buxton. As a second option, in talking with Buxton, we wanted to see if there was possibility for a longer-term contractual option at a lower cost for the city, if we're going to be a partner and have this strategy take place. So that second option that you have is, of course, a 3-year contract, and it removes that termination for convenience. So it would be a whole 3-year contract at $45,000 a year. You still have termination for cause. So if defaulted, if they weren't fulfilling their obligations for the services, then we could still cancel. But I just wanted to outline those two options. 3-year contract at $50,000 with a, you can turn it after 1 year if you're unhappy with the services, or a 3-year contract with only termination for cause at $45,000 a year.
I'm confused, Bo. You gave me 2 3-year contracts here.
Well, let me help with that. Almost all of our consulting contracts are 3-year contracts with option to renew 2 1-year times, okay? But we also have a clause in there that says even though it's a 3-year contract, we can cancel the contract without cause anytime we would like. And so that would be our standard language, and that's $50,000 a year. But that way it's still, we know it's $50,000, and a year from now they can't come back and say, well, now it's $75,000. So it locks in the $50,000 for the full 3 years and gives them an option of actually doing 2 additional 1-year extensions. Now, the other option was taking out the ability to cancel the contract without cause. So we would be obligated, unless Buxton was to default on the contract, to go the full 3 years. So in essence, you're obligating $135,000 over a 3-year period. And then at the end of that, we can renew it 1 year at a time. No obligation on either part to go beyond the 3 years. Is that helpful?
Somewhat. We're considering either doing nothing going with a three-year contract with a fixed three-year cost, or going with a three-year contract with the ability to cancel without cost after the first year?
Yes.
Council,
let me jump in.
Please do.
If you don't mind, and see if here's how I take it. Yeah, other than the first option that you indicated, Mr. Vice Mayor, which is not go forward with this agenda item. In other words, don't choose to enter into a contract with Buxton. Your two options with Buxton would be to do. They're both three-year deals. But what you're doing in the first option, which is $50,000 per year, so it's $50,000. If you go through the whole contract, it's $50,000 first year, $50,000 the second year, $50,000 the third year. But what you get for that extra $5,000 per year is you get an insurance contract. It means you can cancel upon 30 days' notice. You could cancel at any time during that three-year span without cause, for any reason whatsoever, you can cancel. You're paying $5,000 extra per year for that right. The second option is you're paying $5,000 less per year, 45, 45, 45. But you don't have the right to cancel without cause. You still can cancel, but you're going to have to establish, and there's four or five grounds in the contract, set forth in the contract, for which create cause. In other words, you have to establish that essentially Buxton dropped the ball. They didn't do what they were supposed to do, and so you have the right to terminate. So that, to me, is the difference, is that you're paying a little extra and you're getting a little something more.
Well, Council, we all clear on that?
Yeah, and all I would like to say is something like this, a year isn't going to give us anything. It's got to have the 3 years. We're going to, whichever way we vote, I think we need to go the 3 years to see. I mean, nothing's going to happen in 2 or 3 months. So it really needs that term. And if they're not doing their job, we can still get out of the contract. My thought is that we save the money and we give it its term to actually show us if it's working.
Before I make a motion, I have one more question.
Please do.
What's the nearest local government you're working with?
Homestead, Florida.
Good enough.
I move that...
Far enough, you mean.
Far enough, yeah.
I move agenda item number 5, a resolution approving a contract with Buxton Company for strategic planning and business recruitment. Option number 2, the 3-year contract at $45,000 per year.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries without objection. Yeah, you did, Jack.
On the money?
Jack? Okay. God, this is fun. Agenda item number 6. Applies to you, Jack. It has to do with nuisance abatement. Resolution approving the nuisance abatement initial assessment. Mr. Landon.
Yes, Mayor, City Council, Vice Mayor. This is an annual notification process. You know, throughout the year, we have property owners. Many of them are absentee property owners who don't take care of their property and meet our standards. Don't mow the yard, fire mitigation, a variety of code violations. Once they get the notice from us and they fail to correct the situation, then we go through a process and we actually correct it for them on their property. We hire contractors to do the mowing, etc. This process here now will place that cost, the cost that the Palm Coast taxpayers have put out for bringing properties up to code, on those individual property owners' tax rolls. And now you have to go through this notice process that says, we have expended tax dollars on your private property, and now we're just adding it to your tax roll, so when you pay your taxes, you will reimburse the taxpayers of Palm Coast. This doesn't have any impact on anybody who did not have a code violation, or if they did have a code violation, they took care of it themselves. This is only those that the city had to actually come out and perform the work. But usually, I think all the time, we contract with somebody to actually perform the work. This is a preliminary notification. Later, I think it's in August, maybe September. Is it September? We will do a final notification, and that notification then will go on to the tax collector and the county, at the county. This gives people an opportunity to either correct the situation or dispute that they actually should be charged, and so this puts them on notice that and gives them an opportunity to say, no, that this is wrong property or whatever the reason might be, or we find that some people go come and pay it and take care of it between now and the time it actually goes on their tax rolls.
And this wouldn't have anything to do with Matanzas Woods. It's completely different when it comes to them, right? Because there's no building on the property.
I will give you an update on Matanzas Woods, but Matanzas Woods, we have not actually gone on their property and made any corrections, so they are not included on this list.
Other council questions?
Yes.
Please.
There are several pages of properties that we've done work on, and the vast majority of them are for overgrown conditions. And in your statement there, Mr. Landon, you said they weren't meeting our standards. Barbara, perhaps, or I don't need an answer today, but if our standards for overgrown were changed by an inch or two, how would it affect this list? Are these severe cases? I know they're repetitive cases because I can see that, but are they severe cases, or is it every time someone hits 12 inches, we give them an opportunity, but they don't take it, and we...
How do you characterize severe, Jason?
Probably 18. I don't know. I don't know.
They're predominantly abandoned properties, so they are repetitive, so you start the process each time. So you don't get it up to here. You start it at here so that you can get it abated so that it doesn't get to that degree.
So you're doing that, but you know there's no one there who's going to do it anyway.
That's correct.
And they're given every opportunity to do it themselves, correct?
That's correct. They're given notice, yes. And some of them, on a lot of the abandoned properties now, we're seeing a reduction now because they do have property maintenance and they are taking care of the problem. So you're seeing the abatements going down.
Mm-hmm. But there's that other side. That's the neighbor that complains and wants to know why it takes us so long to get it corrected.
That's correct.
And, and many of these are generated by complaints. Many of them are code enforcement officers knowing that this property has been abandoned, and they keep the process going each time so that the neighborhood doesn't have to put up with the real tall grass.
So I think I understanding between both of you what you just said, we start at a reasonable or fairly reasonable level, because what's the there's an initial 30 days, then there's a code hearing, right? So we're at 60 days.
The remedy is posted on the property. They have 30 days to correct the violation. Mm-hmm. If they don't correct the violation, we notice them that in 30 days the city will. So there's a 60-day period.
Right, and at that time, the 12-inch overgrown condition went to whatever.
Right.
Right, and that's why...
This time of year, it's about 30 feet now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's my
question. And council member, this is not your standard code enforcement process. This is under public nuisance abatement.
That's correct.
Which was adopted several years ago by this council to deal with just these very situations that, I mean, it's working. Instead of having to go through the laborious, time-consuming code enforcement board process, this provides an alternative remedy for code enforcement to take direct action with due process to the property owner to let them know that the city is going to go out and take direct action to help the neighborhood.
Mr. Reichman, if the property is in the process of being foreclosed, who's responsible for maintenance?
The property owner, which is the mortgagee.
Okay. Any other questions? Anyone from the public wish to be heard from on this initial nuisance abatement? Seeing no one approach the podium, we'll come back to council. Questions, comments, or a motion?
Move approval of agenda item number 6, a resolution approving the nuisance abatement initial assessment.
Second. Motion is moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. This brings us to the consent agenda portion of our program. Does anyone from the public wish to remove an item on the consent agenda for discussion? Does anyone on the council wish to remove anything for discussion?
Just one, Mr. Vice Mayor. 15263. I just have a couple of questions on that one. 15263.
Which?
Item 9.
9?
Oh, okay, maybe. I don't know.
Okay, no. Item 9. Okay.
Oh, item 9.
Yeah. All right. Any others?
Move approval of the consent agenda, excluding agenda item number 9.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor? Say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Back to agenda item number 9, Mr. Nobile.
A couple of questions. I don't know if we have who we need here to answer, but first question is, when are we anticipating the future development from the proposed addition now to Ulaterne Trail? So that's in future. Well, you guys are snappy right up on top of that.
Lucky.
Oh, look at that. Same picture I'm looking at. Very good. So that the dotted that says future.
Yes.
When
yes,
is sir. That planned?
Steve, if you don't mind, Steve, for the audience, if you will kind of explain what you're showing up there. Yes. And what those lines mean. I know City Council understands.
Sure.
That, but I think
yep.
The public would
certainly be glad to. Thank you. What you're seeing here is a map, and I'll try and point out here a little bit. You got State Road 100 here, so east to west this direction. North is up on the map. And south this way, we're looking at Seminole Woods Boulevard here, and then once you get across 100, it's Town Center Boulevard. The purple lines here that you see are our currently active reclaim water transmission system that's within Town Center. We are proposing in this contract with Klein Construction to build this portion in the green from the north side of State Road 100 right away down just south of the agenda item you heard earlier today, the Airport Commerce Center modification. Mm-hmm. Plat to allow for the new gas station that's going to be built in this area, and get basically the reclaim line built and out of the way of those improvements so that we won't have to one, more economical to do it now than later and tear up the gas station property and have to restore it.
Okay, and then the future is
in the future,
when?
What you see here.
Yeah, what are we thinking?
We actually have this proposed in the fiscal year 16 budget, and we also put it in there with application for grant money or cost share money.
Okay.
From the district, so we're hoping to get cost share money again. We applied for it last year, and we missed it on this portion of the reclaim for Seminole Woods. We got it for a couple other projects like Matanzas Woods.
Okay.
Reclaim Main and the Royal Palms Reclaim.
Okay.
That are both being built today, but we missed it on this one. We're hoping to be able to get it.
Okay.
For
right. Now, the existing pipe on the north and south end are active, meaning there's reclaimed water running to them.
On the when you say south end,
if you go down of Seminole Woods,
down here,
go
yeah.
down a little bit,
down,
sir. Arrow down.
Yeah, if you scroll down some, yeah, it's right there.
Okay.
So you've got that purple there, active, and then the active
okay.
down.
Let me correct my map maker. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
I must not have looked that far down when I was looking at my map maker.
Okay.
Mr. Nobile, This is installed but not active.
Okay.
So let me modify and correct.
My next question is going to be, why are we doing that pipe from one to the other? Yeah. Okay, then we're good.
That was installed when that development occurred. See the street? Yeah, it's not active. It's what we call a dry line.
I was just confused. I was trying to figure out, well, if they're both active, mm-hmm. why are we running a pipe all the way up Seminole Woods?
Appreciate that.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Good.
Okay, I'm good.
If I could further highlight that the line is actually intended to go all the way down to Grand Landings subdivision. Grand Landings, their yards, it's a residential development that's actually quite active right now with construction. Their yards have irrigation lines that this reclaim, which is treated wastewater, so that they would actually be not using either wells or potable water for their lawn irrigation. And that's one of the purposes of this whole program is to try to reuse wastewater versus good drinking water.
Well, my two questions were, why are we doing that now? You answered that. Mm-hmm. And then why are we running that Seminole Woods if both ends are already? Okay, so I'm okay.
Good. Jason?
Steve, on the southern end there, those pipes that are already installed, does that connect with Grand Landings, or is there another
not.
Section?
There's another future piece between this part and Grand Landings.
And is your grant that you've
would attempt to get us all the way down
all the
Grand
way to
Landings.
Grand Landings?
Yes. Okay. And there's good potential that, depending on the way the CIP looks, even if we don't get cost share money this year, it may make sense to put this line in and actually propose back to council to build this line based on the growth of the Grand Landings area and such.
We have customers ready for it.
We have customers ready. And, you know, if you wait, in my professional opinion, if you wait too long, those customers hook into the wells, and they're not going to get off their wells too easily either. So we don't want to miss that boat, so to speak.
Other council questions? The chair will entertain a motion for agenda item number 9.
I think you need to go to the public.
I went to the public.
Oh, we did?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Move approval of agenda item number 9, a resolution approving a contract with SC Klein Construction for the construction of the Seminole Woods Boulevard Reclaimed Water Main Project.
Second. Moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. This brings us to the public portion of the meeting, public participation. You're welcome to come up and talk for no more than 3 minutes on any subject which you wish to do so. Please approach the podium, give us your name, limit your comments to 3 minutes, please.
Good evening.
City Manager Landon. My name is Ronald E. Pukigo. I live in the W section on Woodston Lane. I'm here today to call attention to what may be an unsatisfactory condition of many of our drainage ditches due to excessive vegetation 1, 2, and 3 feet tall. I have provided all of you with pictures to document this condition. The stormwater system in the city of Palm Coast of 1,100 miles of swales, 154 miles of drainage ditches, 84 miles of canals, and finally 31 water control structures is an engineering masterpiece. The critical factor in this system is the drainage ditches, wet or dry, which are tasked with moving stormwater from the neighborhood street swales to the freshwater canals where water volumes may be managed by the water control structures. Per the literature, excessive vegetation in drainage ditches may have an impact on optimal water flow. The literature is rich with this view. One such site, sponsored by the University of Florida, says the following. Vegetation in ditches and canals not only reduce the cross-sectional area of the channel, it also reduces the velocity of the water flow. As a result, aquatic vegetation in waterways may dramatically increase the time required to drain Pacific storm compared to clean ditches that allow a free flow of water runoff. There exists a model which details hydraulic resistance by vegetation. It is called the Manning equation. One may access this theorem on the internet. With this in mind, I believe the City Council must review its decision to allow our wet ditches to remain in a more natural state. As an aside, in 1997, prior to moving to Palm Coast, I was a loaned executive to the Fairfax Falls Church United Way campaign in Northern Virginia. In one presentation at an engineering firm, I met a coastal engineer who had just returned from a three-month assignment in Palm Coast. I asked about water issues, as Palm Coast is located in a semi-tropical area where one may have, from time to time, torrential rains. He replied, "It is the finest drainage system in the state of Florida." I've never forgotten that. Of course, I didn't realize the place could burn at that point. Well, as an aside, I moved in on Friday, and I believe the following Thursday, they says, "Get the hell out of here, it's burning down." But to get back to my presentation, it is the finest drainage system in the state of Florida, and I think that's a worthy goal to maintain. And I thank you, and Godspeed with your deliberations on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next commenter.
Before I speak, I would like to provide the council with some papers. Who should I?
Give the city clerk, please.
Good evening, Vice Mayor and council members. My name is Deborah Susswine. I live on Freeland Lane in Palm Coast. And I've experienced a number of problems in the last couple of years regarding code enforcement. Now, I have been harassed by one of my neighbors, and I know that harassment is not in the jurisdiction of code enforcement, but one of the aspects of the harassment has to do with a number of complaints this neighbor has filed with code enforcement. I know it's him. A lot of people know it's him. Barbara knows it's him. Larry knows it's him. Neighbors know it's him. He's a real problem in the neighborhood. And the thing is that the anonymity, I think, is a problem in and of itself. I would like to see a change in the policy for making complaints. I'd like to have all complaints that are made through code enforcement be signed. I think the anonymity makes for real problems. This neighbor, who I think is cowardly, and he's a sniper, he does this, and I know that other people who are making frivolous complaints and sniping can do this more readily if they're complaints are anonymous. I've spoken to a couple of code enforcement people, and I know that they have an overloaded burden of complaints to answer. And a few of them who I've spoken to agree that the anonymity is probably adding to the burden. If they didn't have all the frivolous complaints to respond to, they would be they wouldn't be overloaded, and they can deal with real problems for code enforcement. That's the anonymity. So I would like to see some kind of policy change where the complaints would have to be signed. The other aspect of what I've been dealing with is the arbitrariness and the inconsistencies in the code enforcement regarding lawn length, weeds, and whatnot. I've received, I want to backtrack a little. The first page that I've given you will show that in 2014, last year, just 1 year ago, there were a lot of complaints by this one person. They're anonymous, so you don't know that it's that one person, but I just wanted to give you that as a postscript or a footnote. The arbitrariness is illustrated in the second sheet that I've given you. The code enforcement officer who came to my property on the 1st of July looked at my property from the front lawn. He looked at the backyard, and he said that the grass is so long there that that would probably be a code violation. 4 days later, I mowed the lawn, and you have that picture, too, on the 5th of July, and it looks the same. It really is not very different. I think there are different standards here. I don't think that there's uniformity and consistency, as I said, in enforcing the code. So I think that there really should be standards that all of the officers follow. So that's basically it. Also, I think that the spirit of the law is really important, too. I live on a property that was built years before all the properties around me. And one of the issues that I have that makes it difficult to mow, when everybody else mows, is that I get the Everglades. I get my land is swamped, especially in the backyard, because the land is much lower than my neighbor's. So that has slowed down the mowing. So I appeal also to the spirit of the law in the sense that it's very picky. I think it's very picky, especially when you see that second picture. And I think that there should be a little bit of mercy with a justice.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Next.
Ron DeCosta, Palm Coast. I would just like to know if there is a code for having blue tops on a roof and how long that blue top can stay on a roof. I've noticed a blue top off of Belterra now for at least a couple of years, and they don't seem to be doing anything about it, and I'm sure that we haven't had any storms that blew their shingles off in the last two or three years, that they have to remain with that blue top on the roof. So I was just wondering if we have a code, or is there a time limit as to when a blue top should be removed after a storm and given the homeowner time to reshingle their house. Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker.
Lewis McCarthy, Palm Coast. A neighbor of mine came up to me and he said, Louis, you know, I went to Indian Trails complex to watch one of his granddaughters play soccer or something like that. And he said, they have a problem there. I said, what's the problem? He said, the bathrooms were way over there, and I was way over here. And I'm not a little boy anymore. I can't go in the bushes. He said, when they have something where each one of these fields are being used, they have to have more than one bathroom. Spread the joy. And so I said, I would come and speak about it in a way that I would understand. He said, oh yeah, you would understand it. Your prostate isn't exactly good either. That's it. About bathrooms at the complex. That's the problem.
Thank you, Lewis. Next speaker.
Good evening, George Mayo, Palm Coast.
I've been out of town for a few weeks. I was here approximately a month ago, and I asked the council to concur with Flagler County, which passed two resolutions, one being Senator Nelson's bill, number 1171, against sonic testing for oil off the out in the Atlantic, and the second one was to concur with the resolution they passed being against fracking, hydraulic fracturing, and it was going to be looked into. So me having not been here, I don't know if anything has been done on that subject. Number two, the public works workers do a fantastic job of cleaning up the trash. I have no problem with them. I live off Zebulas Trail and Beltair Boulevard, and that is a bus stop, and it's a vacant lot. When they clean up the trash in their little ATVs or whatever it is, right before mowing, they do a great job. 10 feet in from the trail where they go down at that bus stop, parents, they just throw out coffee cups, trash, etc. All I ask is that maybe these ATV riders can just, it's 10 feet in, I mean, that's all they can do, and they could pick up a lot of trash. I pick a lot of it up myself just to keep the neighborhood nice. I'm not asking them to go down the street and side streets or anything, but when they see a bus stop, and especially being a vacant lot, so, you know, if somebody were to live there, I'm sure that wouldn't be there, but just ask the public works workers to cut in 10, 15 feet and pick up some of that trash when they go by. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next speaker. Next speaker. Seeing no one approach the podium, we will cut off public participation, come back to council. But first, Mr. Lannon, who should address the excessive vegetation in swales and ditches?
Well, you might recall, I don't know, about a year ago, we actually did a little evaluation of wet ditches and the cost of trying to maintain those. These are, so people will know, these are actually ditches that flow into the canal, and the canal backs up into them. I mean, just the hydraulics of it is, mm-hmm. it's almost like a finger off of the canal. So it has water in it all the time, which obviously means you cannot just go mow it with our typical mowing equipment. And so, you know, buying specialty equipment and having a crew that actually goes and tries to remove the vegetation. We made that presentation to City Council. It's obviously very expensive. It's very time-consuming. You can't get to very many very long when you're, you know, trying to deal with water. And the decision was made to continue with our current program. And our current program, once again, we do mow dry ditches twice a year, and we go around twice a year. And then we have the rehab program is tied into our modeling, and this is where a few years ago we started with one in the R section. We've completed some in the B section, and now we're up in the L section, where we actually would might call rehab the ditches and bring them back to their original condition. Yes, there's no question about the fact that vegetation does have an impact on the water flow.
But we have people that go in and spray defoliants in there, do we not? And also there's some kind of a barge that I've seen out there chewing up.
In the canals.
In the canals.
But those barges and cannot get into the wet ditches.
Okay.
And that's why it would be a whole different program. And it's a matter of priorities, as you know. We have people you see quite often want us to mow the dry ditches more often and say that, well, I have to mow my property. Well, the city does too, except for we do treat it basically like the vacant lots and leave it in more of a natural state. It is a matter of priorities, and I agree with the gentleman that we have an excellent system, and we're spending millions of dollars every year maintaining that system and making sure it continues to operate correctly. There's not very many places that you can have a community like ours and get 12 inches of rain in one day, one night, and not have any structural flooding. And we're very fortunate to have that here. Every system has its capacity, and we reached that last year. But it would be either adding revenue, adding to the level of service, or else shifting it. Now, what that also said is that this year, you know that, you know, you're going to have come up with budget and stormwater, a tough decision about wet swales. And do we try to raise the level of service on the swales in people's yards that stay wet because of the hydraulics and the fact that they were actually being fed by groundwater? And that's an expensive proposition. So the whole system costs a lot, and it's a matter of city council as to how much you want to put into it.
What are there no organic suppressing options for the vegetation? I mean, one, what you were just talking about, that's removing the water. But what this gentleman's talking about is the vegetation.
The wet swales would be trying to pipe the water. That's a different issue. I'm just saying that issue is coming your way, too, and that has additional costs.
Right.
The ditches are the wet ditches. There's no way of piping it. That won't happen. You've got a whole different situation.
But the vegetation, can we, you know, is a tremendous expense to get the equipment for that. But is there any organics way to suppress the growth of the vegetation? And I'm asking you, not knowing that, not expecting you to know the answer to that.
Right. And there is some spraying. We do spraying. We do spraying in canals. We do spraying in some of the ditches. It's like, it's Florida, though, and you spray it, and 3 months later, it's coming back.
So when it comes up, at the time that it comes up before the council, as you had indicated, in the future, we'll be able to look at some costs if we wanted to expand the service.
If you want to have this option brought back to you, we already have that presentation. We'd be happy to bring it back to you. We have a couple of new council members that haven't seen it. Maybe it's time to visit that. I would suggest you do that at the same time you look at the wet swells, and those are a couple of possible ways of raising level, we call it level of service, we're raising our maintenance efforts.
Yeah, but I would like to see more options besides the ones were shown.
And the cost
because
of them.
Apparently if the last council didn't think it was feasible, you know what I mean? I don't want to see the same.
I don't know that.
I don't know that there are either.
Others, we can do that if city council wants to take a look at it.
I remember one very expensive, crazy looking contraption Tony Capella said, you could do it with this thing, but it's going to cost you a whole lot of money. And
kind of like a moon rover
it breaks down often.
A lot of hydraulics and water. And we've got a variety of things that and they can be very, very tall or very high. Some of the water levels very high. You want me to go on to the other issues?
Well, it's the next issue is the code enforcement policy. What would it take to change the policy to eliminate the anonymity?
I think I will ask Barbara to come up and address some of the code issues. There's another whole side, and there's consequences that neighborhood feuds are something code deals with quite often, and there's a lot of people who don't really want their neighbors to know that they're the ones that turned it in, and there's good reasons for that because of retaliation that we see. But Barbara, if you could address it, I'd appreciate it.
There are several ways of reporting a code, one being on the website, which is citizen tracking, another being walking into the office, and another one telephonically. A lot of times you'll find that the person is calling and doesn't want to give their name because of the fact of retaliation, and it can get really ugly. I mean, to the fact of coming home and their windows have been cracked, spray painted, fences. It's just unbelievable. And then there's elderly people that have lived there a long time, and they get somebody new into the area that's not the other person that used to be there, and they're very frightened. And sometimes they're even frightened, and they contact the sheriff's department. And then the sheriff's department sometimes has to tell them that this is an issue that is not dealt with the sheriff's department. Please stop calling. This is something either is civil or it's a code action.
Why? I think, though, there's two sides. There's that side, and then there's the side of the neighbor using it as a weapon against their neighbors. My thing was, if we might be able to collect the names of the people who are making the complaint, but keeping it inside the code enforcement, and you're giving me an excuse which I understand, but you're not addressing the other side of people. I hear more of people getting abused by neighbors than I do of neighbors getting attacked because they complained.
And the anonymity pretty much is retaliation in itself.
Well, yeah,
you're afraid of the retaliation from people finding out who called, but that's what the people who called, not giving their name, that's how they're retaliating against people.
Yeah, so we're addressing half of it, and we seriously need to sit down and fix this, because it is happening a lot on both sides. I'm not going to say what you're saying. What you're saying is correct, but if they give them a name, then they know who it is. But you can't protect their anonymity without protecting someone. We got to protect both sides.
And there's many times that we know that there is another side to the story. We know the situation. We know that it at that time it's going to be unfounded. It's going not to be a code violation. Or we'll get to the point where we'll tell them that there's nothing in the code that says you can't have cardboard hanging out your garage door. That's a civil issue. You have to take that up with your neighbor. Mm-hmm. If it's not a violation, it's not a violation.
Could I interject, Councilmember Nabil and Councilmember Shipley? One thing I think it's important for the public to understand that code enforcement is one of its jobs is to be there to receive complaints. But it's very, very important for everyone to understand that a complaint does not equal a violation. Mm-hmm. Complaint simply starts the process. And there are a series of codes that these folks that are hired by this council through your city manager are to enforce, and those codes are very clear, and they have objective standards. So there is a limited discretion that code enforcement officers have when they receive a complaint, no matter what kind of complaint it is, whether it's written, whether it's on the internet, whether it's a phone call, whatever. All that triggers is an inspection. So these code enforcement officers are going to use their common sense. I see it when I'm the attorney for the code enforcement board every month, and I hear their testimony for these 50, 60 hearings every month, and they use their common sense, and they use their what limited discretion they have under our series of codes. And if the code enforcement officer receives, let me just for sake of argument, the 10th complaint on the same property from the same anonymous source in 1 month, they're going to go out there and they're going to investigate it. They're going to use their common sense. And I see it happen. And if there's not a code violation, that's the end of it. If there is a code violation, there's a warning notice. Well, and if there's no compliance after a warning notice, then there's a notice of violation. And this is all pursuant to statute.
I understand that.
The process is not made up.
I understand that, but is somebody making 10 or 12 calls a month that when the code enforcement goes out there is no violation, that's costing me money.
Yeah. Councilman, well, I bet it is. If I can interject,
yes.
I reconcile this. Me and Barbara have done this in the past. Is when we've had numerous complaints that we've gone in, we've had people come in and say, just with this lady saying it's been unfounded, we'd go three or four times. If we find it unfounded, we've tracked it. And then we've had reversed our decision. You no longer can keep calling in anonymous complaints if we're finding these unfounded calls. We're going
like from the phone number?
From the phone number or from somebody calling, and we've done the same thing with the sheriff's office, a barking dog. I'm just using it for instance. Mm-hmm.
we've four or five times somebody's calling in a barking dog complaint, and we found it to be totally unfounded. Deputies or code enforcement sat there, rolled down the windows, did the due diligence, sat down the road with the windows, not just rolled by and didn't hear them, but actually sat there literally for a half hour, hour, and calls still came in, at which time we said, well, we're no longer going to respond to an anonymous call to that house based on our discretion, and as Mr. Reichman said, common sense. So that's the way we handle it.
But if you have a neighbor that's sitting there during the rainy season, which is now, and they're watching for that grass to hit the code, and pretty much that's, I happen to live on Freeland Lane, so I kind of know the situation, where someone will sit and say, okay, it's raining, the grass is growing a little faster, and today's the day I'm going to call. And then they go out, and there is a code violation, but it's only because it's the rainy season, or...
Normally, with our code officers, we track the rain. We don't go after the homeowners. We know people work. We wait for the weekends. We see what the weather is before we'll even issue a notice.
And you look at the property, too, no? I mean, like, if somebody, you go to somebody and they say, I got a lake back there, you'll go back there and...
Correct,
see
and there may be an individual when you're driving up saying, my lawnmower's broke. We'll give them the reasonable time. Mm-hmm. And we'll come back and do a reinspection. The lawn is mowed. The case is it's over.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the bigger issue here is, if there is one, is that there are people who use our code enforcement department as a weapon against you. I live next door to Carmen. I don't like Carmen, so I'm going to invent all kinds of stuff to see if I can get him in trouble just because I don't like him.
Mr. Vice Mayor, I think this is a large enough of a discussion that with some consensus, I'd like to move this to a workshop so we can have a broader discussion about it, because I have some ideas that maybe I had a long conversation with Ms. Susswine, and you know, we talked about a lot of things, and she makes some good points, but I think unfortunately in our society we have to be very careful because not everyone is as well-intentioned as everyone else. So, but I think I have some ideas that how we could protect the citizens, but also try to reduce the number of frivolous or retaliatory calls.
With council concurrence, we'll ask Mr. Lannon to put that on a workshop.
Agreed.
And I'll be looking for what other communities do and best practices and those types of items as part of the discussion. And probably the depth of repeat calls from, like the volume of repeat calls from citizens and that type of stuff. So we can understand if it really is a problem.
Mm-hmm. So be okay. Next...
Don't go away. you got a blue tarp to address.
No, it's a tap.
Tap.
A tap. 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 You said tap. Blue tarpaulins on the roof that have been there for an excessive period of time. What do we do?
It really depends on the circumstances. If the individual is an occupied property and there's a code violation, then we would be giving them a warning notice, giving them a reasonable time to correct the violation. If the violation isn't corrected in the reasonable time, it would be scheduled for the next available code board. It would go to the code board. Staff would give their recommendation indicating that they have so many days in order to replace the tarp. If they didn't replace the tarp in that reasonable time, then a fine would start.
Replace the tarp or remove the tarp?
Remove the tarp and repair the roof.
So if I had roof damage in the Starlight tornado and put a blue tap on my roof and it's still there, I'm in violation of a code. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Which code is that?
Which code is it? Yeah. It would be maintenance code, chapter 15.
So if you could see the gentleman...
Yes, I'll get an address
and we'll address.
And we want your name.
Restrooms at Indian Trails. We've got a
Yes. Actually, it's let me describe what we do have and then where the problem area is.
Yeah, just keep it clean.
We actually have three restrooms out at Indian Trail Sports Complex. That is the actual city's park. One of them is there at the baseball, softball complex. And then we have right next to that a couple soccer fields. It has a little playground and restrooms. And then as you get closer to the school, we have another restroom with concessions. And that was planned for the park. Since that time, we have expanded the complex onto the middle school property. So you cross over a little bridge that goes over the pond, and we have, I think it's five, maybe six more fields at that location. There are no outdoor restrooms on the middle school property. And when we have large tournaments, they bring porta potties out. I do not know if it's a practice, if it's a small group, they're going to have to walk over the bridge and come to the city restroom. This is something that we've actually, and I don't know where the park team is, but on this issue, but
right
the park,
there. There they are.
Park team has actually talked about this. Lorraine, do we have this in the capital improvement plan? Can you fill us in on the date that we are planning to?
Hurry up, I got to go to the bathroom.
I know that we have it in our capital improvement plan to try to address this and work with the school district, but I don't remember what year.
Yeah, it's within the five-year plan. It's at least 2 years out, and it depends on, you know, we talked about the grant funds through TDC and that being a part of it for the expansion project up there. So that won't be available to us until after this calendar year, and then we'll move forward with trying to figure out, you know, putting that in sooner in the five-year plan. So, but it's not coming up in this current next fiscal year.
Okay.
So, but the groups, just so you all know too, the groups have the opportunity to bring in portable restrooms, and we always recommend that they do that when they are using those additional fields on that side of the park. So,
right, question.
Luann, you say opportunity. Is there a threshold where they're required to bring in?
There is. We haven't exceeded it yet where it's required. It's more for convenience factor than anything else. Typically, during regular soccer practices that are on that field, teams are in and out all day long, so we never have that impact of that total number of people on site at one time that would require them. But as a matter of convenience, and with children especially, you know, trying to get from field 10 to the restrooms is, you know, challenging with especially a small child.
So you're communicating the site conditions with the promoter so they understand.
Absolutely,
right,
yeah.
That they may want to.
Yeah, and I tell them directly that, you know, our biggest complaint that we hear from people attending events or even practices with our local organizations is just the lack of restrooms on that side. Always recommend get them. Even if people don't use them, you have them there, they're available, and, you know,
if the city was going to put in more restrooms, do you have locations in mind where you think they should be?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You may want to consider submitting a request to the Tourist Development Council capital fund at their next year for that, because, you know, tourism is a big deal up at Indian Trail Sports Center.
Yep, and that's exactly what we plan to do. As soon as we're eligible again, that's what we hope to do.
Okay. Right now we're broke, but next year maybe.
It sounds good.
Okay, the gentleman asked a question about fracking and sonic testing for oil that was discussed at some length at a workshop, and basically the city took no action on it because we're part of the county, and the county has already taken a position, so we, I guess, fall in line with them. No one seemed to feel that strongly, either pro or con, about fracking in terms of what the city of Palm Coast may or may not do. Trash at bus stops. The guys on the little all-terrain vehicles, how far can they go off the sidewalk to pick up trash? They can't pick up trash on private property, can they?
Exactly. We in the neighborhoods, we're talking about the only time we pick up the trash in those neighborhoods is before we mow in front of those vacant lots. But it's actually illegal, obviously. It's called trespassing for us to cross over and start picking up the trash. If it is bad enough, and this is one of those where, you know, are we harassing people or not, it is a code violation to not keep your property clean. So we could ask code to send out a notification and require the property owner to clean it. In this case, it's that's always a difficult one because it's the other people littering that is causing the problem, and so this is where you're going to get into conflicts.
What about asking our friends on the school board to send a notice home with the students telling them that litter at bus stops is a problem?
We've had another gentleman here complain as well.
Yeah.
Our section.
Yeah, I guess they could send out the notice. I would probably question that it has a whole lot of impact.
I would question that too, but it's, I mean, that's where it's coming from. We ought to try to identify it at the source.
Ms. Linden?
Okay. Yeah, please help me.
I'll give the address and I'll ask the deputy to go down there.
Okay.
There we go.
Thanks, Mark. Okay, that brings us to the end. I think you still had some questions, but your public time is over. But we have a staff member back there that forgot more about vegetation than I'll ever know, and I'm sure he'd give you a few minutes.
But Vice Mayor, if I could ask that you go back up to item D. We had a announcement of a public hearing date that needs to be read.
Why did I miss that? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Announcement of public hearing date from the Northeast Florida Regional Council. Who's going to announce it?
I you want to read it? You're a reader.
I'm volunteering.
All right.
Yeah, he reads real fast.
All right. This is an announcement of a public hearing. The Northeast Florida Regional Council has provided notice to the City of Palm Coast that a public hearing date may be set for the South Old Kings Road development of regional impact. Pursuant to State Statute Chapter 380.06, a public hearing shall be held no later than 90 days after issuance of notice by the regional planning agency that a public hearing may be set. This is to announce that a public hearing will be held on September 1st and September 15th, 2015, for the South Old Kings Road development of regional impact.
If I could add that those are city council meetings, so the September 1st meeting will be at this location at 6:30 p.m., and the September 15th meeting will be at the same location in this room at the community center, and that meeting starts at 9 a.m.
And this is pertaining to the South Old Kings Road DRI.
Right, and if anybody has any questions about that prior to the public hearing, call our planning office and they can fill them in on what the proposal is. This is south of State Road 100.
Okay.
Is this announcement a new state requirement? I don't remember this before.
No, it's only for DRIs.
Oh, so yeah. We haven't seen one in a very long time.
Yes.
Okay.
you don't see them very often.
Okay, that takes us down to discussion by City Council of matters not on the agenda. Mr. Nobile?
I've got nothing today, Mr. Vice Mayor.
Oh.
I know.
Mr. DiLorenzo.
No, sorry.
Mrs. Shipley.
Yeah.
Okay. I have nothing to contribute. Then I usually don't. Discussion by city attorney of matters not on the agenda.
Mr. Vice Mayor, I think I may be talking a little bit during the city manager's report. He indicated some foreshadowing, so I will hold my ammunition until then.
Well, you're wrong. I told him I was going to throw him under the bus, and it's all going to be his fault. So
here we go.
That moves us directly to the city manager of matters not on the agenda. Go get him.
Before I pick on the city attorney, I do want to point out here that the county has a public meeting about public transportation in Flagler County. As you know, the public transportation system is operated by the Flagler County, and they're looking for input. This is a lot of people are concerned about the needing to increase public transportation. It will be held at the Emergency Operations Center. That's the center there in Bunnell, right behind the administration building, the large building with the green roof. And it will be Tuesday, August 11th, from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Or it will be in this room the following night here at the Palm Coast Community Center, Wednesday, August 12th, from 4 to 6 p.m. So that'd be some opportunity to provide feedback and learn more about what's happening in the county public transportation system. My other thing I wanted to update City Council on is our progress at the Matanzas, the abandoned Matanzas Woods Golf Course, and where we are with that effort. We have received a little cooperation from the property owner, but not much. As you know, we really had two major issues. That is just the maintenance of the vegetation, but better known as mowing of the grass, and then also the buildings that are not being kept up, in particular the clubhouse, which is in disrepair. We went forth with our fire marshal, who under state law can enter or do an inspection of the building to make sure that it's not a public safety hazard. Our building official and code officers don't have that same privilege. We can't enter the property, but the fire marshal can, as per our favorite attorney. What that does then, though, is allows us to take pictures and see with the condition of the building. There were some issues that the fire marshal said they had to correct, and it was boarding up, making so it's not accessible, those type of issues. And that's why I said we got a little cooperation, and they came in and took care of the issues that the fire marshal had. But as a result of those inspections and the cooperation, our building official was also authorized by the property owner to take a look at it. The determination on the building from the building official is that it is structurally sound enough that he cannot require it to be demolished. Once again, realize that this is private property with private property rights, and government has to meet some very strong standards before you can come in and require somebody to tear down a structure. And he's saying that it is structurally sound, and he is not able to use the condemnation process to make him bring the structure down. So we are going to our maintenance code, and this is something we haven't used in the past, but our maintenance code does require that structures be maintained in an occupiable condition. In other words, you can't just abandon a structure and let it dilapidate to the point where it is you could not occupy it by the code. And this has been enough vandalism, destruction, and interior that you could not occupy this building. And so we are going through the process with our attorney to enforce that section of our code that basically says you either bring it back to the point where it can be occupied, or you don't have to occupy it, but it just has to be ready to be occupied, or tear it down and give them those choices. And the legal process on that, we have obviously very strict requirements, once again, to come in and do those. So our building official is working with Barbara and the attorney to proceed with that. The other is fires of vegetation, and this is where, been stating that, you're out there on the golf course, you really don't have a structure, and therefore it's difficult to say you have to maintain it the same way you have a structure. Then our favorite attorneys got involved and said, no, legally there are structures. It's all one property. Mm-hmm. So the clubhouse, the restrooms, the maintenance building, and he has come up with a legal determination that it's not a vacant property. It actually has structures on it, and therefore must meet certain minimum standards for the maintenance of the grass area. And so with that determination, We have placed the property owner notice back to what the previous owner had, and that there are minimum standards you must meet and start mowing the golf course. And that unless the property turns vacant, which means all of the structures are removed, then he's going to have to do minimum maintenance. And once again, so Barbara is working towards getting the property owner to make those adjustments and corrections with a legal counsel.
So we know who the property owner is. I know for a long time nobody was sure who owned what.
Well, yeah, it's there is a property owner, but there's a lot of mortgage foreclosures and buying the note and all that. But none of that really affects Barbara's legal process, because we do have to deal with the property owner. But in this case, because of the strange nuances, we are getting our attorney front and center to make sure we try to do this correctly. We also are not, for the city to just take on mowing it, the rest of the taxpayers, the bill would be substantially. And so our instructions to our attorney is to use the format or the process that would force the property owner to mow it and not us, if at all possible. So I didn't throw you under the bus.
I've had worse buses today. I've got worse marks from other buses today. I just wanted to add everything that the city manager indicated is accurate. I just wanted to make sure that the council and the public understands there's really two different routes that the city's taking. One is for the structures. And that's very different than the route for the overgrown grass. And Barbara, correct me if I'm wrong, but with regard to the conditions of the golf course as opposed to the clubhouse, the golf course is being set for code enforcement. There'll be a code enforcement hearing on that, I believe, next month, the August code board. So there's a process that's consistent with the objectives that the city manager has identified tonight with regard to the overgrowth. And that is a different process, and it has time constraints. And as you can tell, we're following the law, the letter of the law, for due process on that. We're going in a different direction with regard to the structure. At this point in time, the health safety issues with the structure have been resolved. Those issues identified by the fire marshal, the fire chief, have been resolved because the place is boarded up. It can't be broken into. As far as how it looks as opposed to the danger, that's being addressed as well.
Okay.
I want to then take this one step further, because we have another property that you don't hear about as much, but we do hear about quite often, and that's the old tennis center, better known as the Players Club. And that is another structure that has been standing for a long time but is not occupiable. We recently have learned that that's wide open. You can just walk on in, and there's evidence of people maybe living in this building. So we're going to pursue the Players Club in the same manner concurrently. And once again, obviously going through all the legal steps, but first have the fire marshal secure the building so it doesn't create a public hazard, and then use the maintenance code to either have them bring the building up to code, which will be very difficult, I've been told. In fact, this one may be in condition that it has to be torn down. We might have to go that route, but we're not far enough along with inspections. That property, anytime we complain about vegetation or just basic grounds upkeep, they always do the minimum. And we don't have the same situation where they don't take care of the minimum, but we're going to take care of the building and also make sure we pursue the minimum upkeep of the grounds. And that will be running concurrently with this one. Both of those properties, it's been too long. And I think the neighbors have a right to see some action.
Anything else, Jim?
That's all I had for tonight. Thank you.
Okay. Please, folks, keep our mayor in your thoughts. He's got some health issues that may be serious. At this time, the chair will entertain a motion to adjourn.
I move we adjourn.
We're adjourned.